Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has targeted Israeli positions in the occupied territories with a barrage of rockets. And Iran's foreign minister says his country has always played a constructive role in order to secure the stability of the region. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli military's relentless attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to take more civilian lives. At least 29 people were killed when a home in central Gaza City was hit. Another 20 civilians lost their lives in Israeli strikes on other areas across the coastal sliver. Israeli forces also targeted a number of journalists in the Nusayrat camp, central Gaza, causing casualties. According to medical sources, one of the journalists is in critical condition. More than 33,600 people have been killed in Gaza since Israel began its genocidal war. Thousands more remain missing. A Geneva-based human rights organization has estimated that over 13,000 Gazans are unaccounted for. Euromed Human Rights Monitor says many of those missing are either under the rubble or have been buried in indiscriminate mass graves. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to give us an update on the latest Israeli attacks against the besieged Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
Israeli attacks are still continued so far, as you know, against Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. More relentless airstrikes and more attacks carried out by the Israeli artillery shelling are still carried out against that refugee camp. The latest attack, as you have mentioned, targeted a group of the Palestinian journalists who were gathering in that area, covering the latest developments on the ground. The Israeli occupation forces deliberately attacked them. That attack actually was documented on the camera, whereas the Israeli tank actually fired a shell towards those Palestinian journalists directly. At least three Palestinian journalists were reportedly injured over that attack. One of them had his right leg actually amputated. He's Sami Shahada. He's the correspondent of TRT channel. He was documenting the current aggression in the Nusayrat refugee camp. So it's another deliberate crime committed by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinian journalists on the ground here, taking the whole number of the Palestinian journalists who have been attacked and who have been killed by the Israeli occupation forces to roughly 140 Palestinian journalists, in addition to hundreds of the Palestinian journalists who got injured over those ceaseless attacks pursued by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinian media in a way that that aims at muting the voice of the Palestinian people and preventing those Palestinian journalists from covering the truth.
A UNICEF car came under fire in northern Gaza earlier this week on its way to deliver aid to malnourished children. That was the latest incident of targeting aid groups by Israeli forces in Gaza, where people are already starving due to the regime's restrictions. Now let's take a listen to a UNICEF spokesperson explaining how the attack happened.
I was in that car that was hit. It was waiting at a holding point just south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, where we are often instructed to wait before being called through the checkpoint. We were waiting there as instructed, and gunfire broke out in the vicinity. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the checkpoint towards civilians, who then turned and fled from the checkpoint. Luckily, myself and my colleagues, we were all safe, but this just underscores how dangerous it is for humanitarian aid workers in Gaza at the moment, that incidents like this continue to happen when they absolutely shouldn't. See, we decided to go ahead because it was such a critical mission, with nutrition products for the children who are malnourished in the north of Gaza, among other things. Unfortunately, after deciding that we would go ahead, we were still delayed. We waited at that holding point for at least another 2 hours before deciding that the mission was no longer feasible because we didn't have enough time, even if we were given the green light, to go up, conduct all of our activities, and then get. It's tragic to see anybody suffering from malnutrition, which is such a painful condition, let alone in a place where malnutrition was almost non-existent before October. It's now skyrocketed in the north of Gaza because of disruptions to food production, but also because of restrictions on aid access to that area. We've really struggled to get up there with aid. And as a result, we know that children are dying of malnutrition there. At least 23 children have reportedly died at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is where we were trying to bring these nutrition treatments on Tuesday.
West Bank have held a funeral for two Palestinians who were killed in an Israeli raid. The two Palestinians were killed in the city of Tubas in the northeast of the West Bank. Mohammed Rasul Darahme was killed after Israeli occupying forces opened fire at his vehicle. Elsewhere in the Central Bank, armed Israeli settlers attacked two villages near the city of Ramallah. One Palestinian was killed and over 20 people were injured. The settlers also set dozens of Palestinian cars and houses on fire. There has been a drastic rise in the number of attacks by Israeli forces and settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Since then, at least 462 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territory. Our correspondent in Ramallah joined us earlier with more details about the Israeli settlers' attack on a village near Ramallah that killed a Palestinian man and injured several others. Let's take a listen.
A third Palestinian has been killed by the Israelis this day, but this time Israeli settlers had killed a young Palestinian man, Jihad Afif Abu Aliya, from the village of Al Mughayyar, northeast Ramallah. The Israeli settlers had raided the village of Al Mughayyar, and they attacked Palestinians and their vehicles, their homes. They burnt properties, they burnt vehicles, they opened fire at the residents of Al Mughayyar, killing one Palestinian and wounding 18 others. At the same time, Israeli forces stormed Al Mughayyar in order, of course, to make sure that the settlers are not being attacked or hurt by the Palestinians there, and at the same time to continue attacking the Palestinians there. Why the Israeli settlers had been raiding Al Mughayyar, it's not the first time. The Israeli settlers continue to storm these areas, northeast Ramallah, like Al Mughayyar, Tir Musa'iyah, Sinjal, and these Palestinian towns and villages are located very close to the illegal settlements that are built on the Palestinian lands. The Israeli authorities claim that a shepherd settler was still missing since the early hours of Friday, and the search is still continuing. They could not, of course, find this settler.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah and Israeli forces have once again exchanged fire as the southern Lebanese border remains tense over the onslaught on Gaza. Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets towards occupied Palestine and the occupied Golan Heights. That after Israeli warplanes targeted several Lebanese villages and towns. Earlier we were joined by a correspondent in Beirut, Mayam Saleh, for more details.
Hezbollah was definitely basically keeping things at a low profile. There was low intensity operations from Lebanon, but we noticed that from the Israeli side, the shelling continued, and we saw an intensification today where they launched and targeted several houses in Aitasha, but also in the town of Taibe, which is still one of the towns that is inhabited. It has not been displaced. It has not been evacuated. It's not a bordering town. So Hezbollah basically made a stance with what we heard from the launching of the Katyusha rockets. Hezbollah has mentioned in their statement that they said tens of rockets were launched towards the barracks of Zaouda. And Zaouda is one of the main barracks where the Israelis basically launch their artillery. It's a launching site. They have many vehicles over there, artillery vehicles especially. They're usually also Merkava tanks in that barrack specifically. So basically, it's a very large military parking lot for their artillery vehicles. Hezbollah made it clear that they are ready to make that stance and to retaliate for the targeting of areas that are considered residential and civilian, although we did not see, we don't have clear casualties from the civilian population, but still in itself, when the Israelis target a civilian house and it is destroyed, then Hezbollah does retaliate in that manner. And we saw that Hezbollah also have taken things a little bit further. After this targeting, they issued some four statements saying that they launched several operations during the day. So after some de-escalation, now we see that the resistance in Lebanon has gone back to the same routine of continuous heavy firing against Israeli targets, whether in the Golan Heights or in occupied Palestinian territory, in occupied Lebanese territory. We have two operations in the Kfar Shuba Hills, the Lebanese-occupied Kfar Shuba Hills in Al Somaka.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has always acted constructively in regional issues and has paid a huge price in order to ensure the stability and sustainable security of the West Asia region. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark during a phone call with his Italian counterpart. He also urged Italy to use its presidency of the G7 group of countries to try to end the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Antonio Tajani, for his part, stated that Italy, alongside the EU, has condemned Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Syria, but called on the Islamic Republic to exercise restraint. Russia says it is open for peace talks with Ukraine based on a 2022 draft peace agreement. However, Moscow says Kiev shows no sign of willingness for negotiations. We have discussed the issue with the possibility of ceasefire negotiations between Moscow and Kiev in our news review program.
On this segment of the program, Russia says a draft peace agreement that was negotiated with Ukraine in 2022 could serve as a starting point for a new round of negotiations between the two countries. The Kremlin spokesman said any potential future talks would need to consider, quote, new realities, echoing the Russian president's remarks on Thursday. Dmitry Peskov added a lot has changed since 2022, including what he said was the addition of four new regions to Russian territory. The draft document that was discussed in Istanbul in 2022 reportedly includes clauses demanding that Ukraine adopt a geopolitically neutral status and not join NATO, limit the size of its armed forces, and grant a special status to eastern Ukraine. Moscow, however, says there is no sign that Kiev is ready for peace talks. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have radio host and journalist at CPR News, Don DeBar, who's joining us from Ossining, New York. And we also have independent researcher and author Greg Simons, who's joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. I want to get your perspective on the recent comments coming from Russia that this previous draft peace agreement that was negotiated back in 2022 could actually serve as a starting point for a new round of negotiations. Are you optimistic about that?
First, the first impression I have of this is that Ukraine is going to keep whatever they, because the last time they did that, and their representative negotiated a treaty, when he got back home to Kiev, they killed him and called him a traitor. So there's that problem. Of course, there are the various efforts by states and others to negotiate some sort of a peace settlement with everyone but Russia, which is insane, of course. Obviously political for consumption at home, not anything that's going to be considered, you know, on the global stage or that's going to be considered by Russia. There have been other agreements. In December of 2022, before the special military operation, as Russia calls it, began, that phase of war began, there were documents sent to NATO and Washington laying out what Russia's concerns were with having basically, you know, an active war directed at Russia conducted on its border. And that was rejected. There were the Minsk agreements that were negotiated and signed over the period of, you know, from post-coup in 2014, that also we found out not only were they not implemented, everyone knew that because the Donbass area was not given autonomy, which was the consideration for it, but also that the individuals from the West who negotiated it admitted publicly, we never intended to carry our part of the bargain. We were just trying to buy time to arm for a war with Russia. So the foundation for this is on pretty shaky ground. Obviously, the logic of any war is that it should be ended through negotiations that are fair and settle the underlying problems between the belligerents or the antagonists. It just doesn't seem that there's anyone that can do that on behalf of Kiev, since Kiev really is nothing but, you know, an agent of Washington, and Washington is trying to damage Russia.
Greg Simons, I want to get your thoughts on the issue as well, whether this agreement will lead anywhere, and whether you agree with our guest, Mr. Don DeBar, that maybe Kiev isn't even actually looking for peace.
Well, I agree fully with Don. I would also add, the moment that Zelensky agreed to go to war against Russia, Ukraine lost all its sovereignty. It became nothing more than a puppet of the United States, and a very desperate and delusional United States that has banked everything on Ukraine winning the war so that it can sort of stop Russia's rise. In addition to that, I would also add that, I mean, the point is Ukraine is in a much worse military, political, economic position now in 2024, in April 2024, than it was in March 2022 in Istanbul. So, I mean, what do they have to bargain with? I mean, they're now trying to scrape the bottom of the barrel for anyone who hasn't run away from conscription or is dead yet.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Radio host and journalist at CPR News, Don DeBar, joining us from Austin, New York, and independent researcher and author Greg Simons, joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gaza children lack access to health care and are not safe in the current unhygienic environment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, displaced Palestinians seeking refuge in the southern Gaza town of Rafah find themselves living amid piles of uncollected trash as garbage trucks are rendered unusable in Israeli regime attacks and fuel shortages hinder regular waste collection, according to a report. Omer Mahmoud Al-Hendi, who fled from North Gaza, told the Anadolu news agency, "We can't sit in the tent due to the smell of the garbage and flies. Children can't sleep because of the flies. A solution needs to be found to this garbage crisis." Hendi said, among family members, in addition to children, there are also the sick, disabled, and elderly. The garbage piling up among the tents and shelters creates an environment conducive to the spread of infectious diseases, said the report. Ahmad Davoud, who was displaced from Gaza City to Khan Yunis and then Rafah, noted that his wife and children were greatly affected by the situation. He told Anadolu, "The immune levels of my three children have decreased. My wife also suffers because part of her liver and spleen have been removed." Pointing to a pile of dirt, Davoud said, "This is just a small pile you see. If the municipality hadn't come yesterday to collect the garbage, it would have reached here." Another Palestinian, Abdul Khadir Ahmad, displaced from Jabalia refugee camp about 5 months ago, highlighted the sewage flowing between the tents. He said, "We are ending very difficult conditions here during the winter. There are many children in the tents, and these children are at risk of many diseases, including hepatitis, intestinal and respiratory diseases. The children here lack access to healthcare and are not safe in this unhygienic environment." He stressed that the tents do not protect from illness and cold, nor provide a humane living space. Hosni Mohenna, the Gaza Municipalities Union Coordinator, told Anadolu that municipalities in central and southern parts of Gaza are unable to provide basic services due to the increasing number of displaced people. Mohenna said services such as garbage collection, sewage disposal, and water pumping is greatly affected by population growth and fuel shortages. Mohenna noted that municipal teams are struggling to cope with increasing garbage piles in Rafah and Deir al-Balah. Roughly 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering in Rafah, many of whom were displaced from other areas destroyed by the Zionist regime in its ongoing military assault on the besieged enclave. As the Zionist regime continues to vow to press ahead with the ground invasion of Rafah, the Secretary General of Doctors Without Borders, Christopher Lockyer, warned last month that clearly any ground invasion into Rafah would be an absolute catastrophe. It doesn't bear thinking about. It would be disaster upon disaster. Palestine Chronicle spoke to Al Ashqar family, who are sheltering in Rafah in a camp where there is little food and even fewer supplies. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the Israeli regime has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7th. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 33,175 Palestinians have been murdered so far, and 75,886 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in the enclave. Moreover, at least 7,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international organizations say the majority of those murdered and wounded are women and children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt. in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Meanwhile, Middle East Monitor wrote, Palestinians who have started living in tents in Rafah, in southern Gaza, after fleeing Israeli regime attacks, are facing the risk of outbreaks due to uncollected garbage. Palestinians in Rafah live amid trash piles as garbage trucks, rendered unusable in Israeli regime attacks, hinder regular waste collection due to fuel shortages. Trash piles among the tents and shelters create an environment conducive to the spread of infectious diseases due to the foul odors they emit and conditions for the formation of pests. Mahmoud Al-Hendi, who migrated from Sheikh Redwan neighborhood in northern Gaza to Rafah, said the current conditions are not suitable for human life. Hendi said among family members, in addition to children, there are also sick, disabled, and elderly individuals. Also, another Palestinian who migrated from Gaza City to Khan Yunis and then to Rafah complained about the garbage and sewage waste issue. He noted that his children and wife were greatly affected by this situation. He said the immune levels of her children have decreased. Another Palestinian, Ahmad, who migrated from Jabalia refugee camp about 5 months ago, drew attention to the sewage waters flowing between the tents. Ahmad stated that these waters cause children to become ill, saying, "We are enduring very difficult conditions during the winter. There are my children in the tents, and these children are at risk of many diseases, including intestinal and respiratory diseases." He stressed that the tents do not protect from illness and cold and do not provide a human living space.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, reciting the Holy Quran as an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Such an honor to be here at your service, A to Z. So we're talking about Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, one of the things that is really important part of our Islamic lifestyle is this recitation of the Holy Quran. And so, you know, as we continue to move farther and farther away from the holy month of Ramadan, we should be able to continue the things that we had started in the holy month of Ramadan throughout the rest of our Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, reciting the Holy Quran was something which was regularly done in that month. And so now, you know, in the month of Shawwal, and of course, you know, these few first days, if you will, that we are born again, our sins, inshallah, have been forgiven, we are pure, we are clean. And so it is in this kind of a situation that we need to make sure we continue this Ramadan lifestyle, this Islamic lifestyle. You know, and the farther we get away from the holy month of Ramadan, the more we're going to start to kind of lose certain small pieces as we move forward, right? So reciting the Holy Quran, it was something that we were doing on a regular basis. And this is what's really important, is to be able to continue that recitation of the Holy Quran. You know, one of the things that we felt in the holy month of Ramadan was how reciting the Holy Quran has this purifying effect. And so, you know, now that we are moving on and, you know, the different problems and aspects and difficulties and challenges that life has and that we are faced with in our life, we really need this purity and this spirituality. And this is one of the ways in which we can attain that purity and spirituality, and really continue to keep us pure as we move forward. And that is the recitation of the Word of Allah, the Holy Quran. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about reciting the Holy Quran as an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle. You know, we were reciting the Holy Quran in the holy month of Ramadan. And so, you know, we kind of, that begs the question is, why can't we do it now that we are past the holy month of Ramadan, right? One of the things is that we need to kind of, you know, schedule and manage our time in a manner where at a specific time we want to allot for the recitation of the Holy Quran, right? You know, we talked about in the previous segment how reciting the Holy Quran itself is a type of purifier, just merely reciting it. But of course, merely reciting it is not the end goal, right? We should read the translation, we should try to understand the Arabic, we should kind of contemplate for a minute or two, at the least, about the verse that we have written. So perhaps maybe every day at a specific time, inshallah, we want to spend, you know, like 4 minutes or 5 minutes to recite, at least one verse of the Holy Quran and start to make it an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle, that we are continuing, right, from our Ramadan lifestyle. And inshallah, this recitation of the Holy Quran is going to definitely bring barakah and blessings from the Almighty Allah, and it will eventually become a very integral part of our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Only through Shia Sunni unity and unity in the axis of resistance can Palestine be free from the river to the sea. And the day is not far when they will pray together at Al-Aqsa Mosque. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, this year's International Quds Day saw millions of people across the Islamic Republic of Iran pour into the streets to reaffirm their unwavering support and solidarity for the people of Palestine. Emotions were high as people rallied to condemn the Zionist regime's genocidal war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, which has already claimed the lives of more than 33,000 people. Amid the hustle and bustle of the annual rally in Tehran, two familiar faces wore the cynosure of all eyes as they walked together to mark the day that was instituted by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, more than four decades ago. They demonstrated in action what the great revolutionary leader strongly advocated: unity against the common enemies, the American hegemony and the Zionist apartheid. The sight of Abu Fadak, the chief of staff of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, PMF, and the leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Ziad al-Nakhale, marching side by side in Tehran, strongly reflected the reality of how far the legacy of late Imam Khomeini has reached. That too on International Quds Day and in the Iranian capital, where it all began in 1979. The rare public appearance of Abu Fadak, a highly respected Iraqi Shia military strategist, and al-Nakhale, a prominent Palestinian Sunni resistance leader, sent a powerful message to enemies. Islamic Republic of Iran, with its predominantly Shia population, has withstood a myriad of economic hardships, crippling sanctions, and acts of terrorism and sabotage for its pivotal role in supporting Palestine, with its predominantly Sunni population, against Zionist American plots. One of the plots has been to divide Sunni and Shia Muslims in a bid to consign the issue of Palestine and the occupation of Islam's third holiest site in occupied Al-Quds into oblivion. However, owing to the wisdom and bravery of the Iranian nation led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, all such nefarious plots have been nipped into the bud. These failed plots have been for years evident in countries such as Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, but more importantly in Palestine, where the axis of resistance with its Sunni and Shia members have together been fighting the Israeli-American war against Palestinians. Abu Fadak and Nakhale are both designated as terrorists by the terrorist regime in Washington. Their crime has been advocating armed resistance against Zionist terrorism and colonialism. Abu Fadak led the PMF following the U.S. assassination of its former leader, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, alongside Iran's top anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, outside the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The predominantly Shia PMF, presented by all the religious and ethnic groups in Iraq, played an instrumental role in defeating the West-backed Daesh terrorist group in Iraq. The predominantly Sunni PIJ is a powerful resistance movement in the blockaded Gaza Strip, which together with Hamas has forced the Israeli regime and its military to eat humble pie. The leaders of the two resistance groups walking shoulder to shoulder on the streets of Tehran for the same cause is a clear representation of Sunni Shia unity. When taking into account how the beliefs and principles of these two men strongly match those of the late Imam Khomeini, this awe-inspiring demonstration of unity in the axis of resistance from Palestine to Iraq, from Shia to Sunni, united against the common enemy, the axis of genocide, was a statement in itself. This unity in letter and spirit is what will pave the way for the victory of the oppressed against the oppressor. It is an image that has given shudders to the US, the Anglo-American Zionist apologies. Those who have openly betrayed the Palestinian cause, such as the Al Khalifa monarchy ruling over the oppressed people of Bahrain, will be shaken by the sight of two resistance linchpins together. This united stance, which is growing stronger by the day as a result of the genocidal war on Gaza, spells the beginning of the end for those aiding the Zionist occupation. The irony is that the US and the UK in particular, who declare themselves as the leaders of the free world and democracy, share close ties with the Al Khalifa regime and ilk. While more than 16,000 Palestinian children have been martyred in the past 6 months, thousands have been rendered hopeless, and many more are starving, state TV in Bahrain has had rolling coverage on everything except Gaza. The slaughter of Palestinians has no news value for them. Real-life heroes such as Abu Fadak and Nakhale have seen their popularity grow over the past 6 months as they have refused to cow down against the occupying regime. On the other hand, those Muslim Arab leaders who betrayed the people of Gaza during their hour of need will soon be forgotten and consigned to the bins of history books. Abu Fadak and Nakhale earned their freedom after years of struggle and resistance. They represent a growing number of like-minded people of resistance who have mutual respect for each other. The leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has repeatedly emphasized the need for mutual respect between the Shia and Sunni and their leaders as the key to foiling foreign plots, freeing Palestine from occupation, and ushering in regional peace and security. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah Resistance Movement, predominantly Shia but includes Sunni members also, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has followed suit by supporting the people of Gaza. This support stretches back decades before Hezbollah's latest operations in the aftermath of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm and the genocidal Zionist war on Gaza. It is not surprising that the Palestinians in Gaza, who are 99% Sunni, have regularly praised the axis of resistance, a growing Shia-Sunni axis, and on top of them, the Islamic Republic of Iran, after defeating the Israeli occupation forces in numerous wars over the past two decades. Only through this Shia-Sunni unity and unity in the axis of resistance can Palestine be free, from the river to the sea. And the day is not far when they will pray together at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Recently, the boastful Israeli military suddenly withdrew almost all of its forces from Gaza over 6 months after launching a bloody but futile war in the hope of eliminating the Palestinian resistance there. The timing is interesting, though. This happened at a time when not just the entire Israeli-occupied territories, but all other Tel Aviv-linked centers in the broader region and beyond have been gripped by sheer panic over possible Iranian retaliation against Israel's deadly act of aggression on Tehran's diplomatic mission in Damascus. In the wake of the Israeli aggression, Iran was quick to promise a response that would make the regime regret the criminal attack, as put by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in a Hebrew tweet. That made fearful Israeli settlers storm ATMs, supermarkets, and other stores to buy essential wartime supplies. The regime also evacuated its mission in several countries and put its military on high alert. With all eyes on Iran to see how it will react, let's have a look at the history and roots of Iran-Israel tensions in a nutshell.
Since the Iranian nation's Islamic Revolution in 1979, the U.S. and the Western powers have kept up a campaign of economic pressure and military threats against Iran in an abortive attempt to stop the Islamic Republic from pursuing its two fundamental ideals in the region, putting an end to U.S. and Western imperialism in the region, as well as the occupation of oppressed Palestine by their puppet regime, Israel. Seeing Iran as a threat to its illegitimate existence in Palestine, Israel has traditionally relied on all-out support from the U.S. and its other masters, whereas the Islamic Republic benefits from its own growing military power and the public opinion in the region in favor of Iran's lofty ideals and against the Israeli occupation.
The Israeli regime has, in the past decades, resorted to U.S.-backed wars, assassinations, ethnic cleansing campaigns, in parallel with more and more land theft to consolidate its occupation. Tel Aviv has also posed overt military threats, even including a nuclear attack threat against Iran. This is while observers believe Iran has played chess with the occupying regime much more intelligently. Tehran has always maintained that it will never initiate any attack against any party, but at the same time, it has always displayed its full military readiness to retaliate against any Israeli act of folly through various direct or indirect means.
Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei has previously warned Israel openly that the Islamic Republic will not hesitate to raise Haifa and Tel Aviv to the ground in case Tel Aviv makes any foolish move. With the guidelines of the leader in the confrontation with Israel and its allies, the Iranian military has always worked tirelessly to build up its combat readiness, including by developing its own military hardware. No need to guess who Iran's defense might is aimed at when one sees various ballistic missiles, drones, or other pieces of Iranian-made defense equipment. Several of them feature Hebrew messages of destruction to Israel or names supporting the Palestinian resistance against occupation. Just recently, Iran unveiled a state-of-the-art drone named Gaza in solidarity with the residents of the blockaded enclave, which have been the target of a shocking Israeli massacre.
An example of Iran-Israel confrontation was the proxy war that the U.S. and its allies joined forces to unleash in Syria in 2011 to unseat the elected government there. Israel, backed by all its regional and extra-regional allies, did everything in its power to bring about the collapse of Damascus, ranging from direct attacks to supporting anti-Damascus terrorists. But it failed to do so only after Iran stepped in and helped Syria get rid of the mercenary militants. Angered by the big Iranian win, Israel still keeps launching air raids in Syria from time to time, including the recent one that targeted Iran's embassy in Damascus.
Iran has not yet responded to Israel's attack on its embassy. Some try to attribute that apparent inaction to what they claim to be Tehran's fear of further escalation. But the history of the confrontation between Iran and Israel seemed to be reflected more precisely in a recent article by The Cradle. Iran's regional policy was beautifully described in an article by The Cradle. It explained that Iran's apparent restraints in the face of Israeli aggression should not be mistaken for weakness. Iran steadily applies pressure on Tel Aviv through its own methods, setting the stage carefully for Israel's unraveling. The article likened Israel to a frog that is being happily boiled to death by Iran as part of the Islamic Republic's long game of reaching strategic objectives.
It remains to be seen how Tehran will respond to the recent Israeli act of aggression on its sovereignty. In general, it seems that the Iranian establishment has the full support of the public opinion in the country for dealing a stinging blow to Israel. But one thing has been repeatedly proven true about Iran. The decision makers in the country will never base their moves on sensations or Israeli-provoked media frenzy. War is grinding on in Gaza. Now almost 33,000 Palestinians have been killed at the hands of Israeli soldiers. Over 75,000 others have been wounded. Most of the casualties are civilians, men, women, and children who are non-combatants. If the Israeli soldiers are fighting the war, which by the way is basically against the civilian population, the war itself is not Israeli only. So many components of it are in fact American, everything from military gear to missiles and fighter jets. In this episode of In a Nutshell, we're taking a look at why it would be wrong to call the war on Gaza a merely Israeli one.
The United States used its veto power at the United Nations Security Council 3 times to keep the war going. A first draft Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire was vetoed by the United States in October of last year, when the war had just started and the civilian fatalities were only beginning to mount. The pretext for killing attacks, as offered by U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield, was that the draft did not mention what she called Israel's right to self-defense. By then, over 3,000 Palestinians had been killed.
Weeks later, on December 8th, when 17,400 Palestinians were dead, the U.S. rejected another Security Council resolution that had aimed to mandate a ceasefire in Gaza. Another U.S. diplomat said that text was rushed and ignored U.S. demands in what was being branded as an Israeli war.
And on February 20th, when another draft resolution was killed by the U.S., Thomas Greenfield claimed a ceasefire would have jeopardized ongoing U.S. activities to halt the war. Of course, the war was not halted as a result of any U.S. activities. It raged on because of them. Meanwhile, more Palestinians were being killed, uprooted, forced to live in squalid conditions, and the humanitarian crisis was only growing.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made several trips to Israeli-occupied territories, claiming that he is working to bring about a ceasefire. His latest was scheduled to take place soon. While the U.S. has a pretense of working to stop the war, everything it does only prolongs it. What the United States has been doing more rigorously in the meantime has been to lubricate the Israeli war machine by constantly replenishing the Israeli arsenal. U.S.-made military hardware has been making its way into Israeli hands.
That contradiction has not been lost on the world. Even the rather Israeli-friendly Palestinian Authority has spoken out. The PA has called Blinken's activities failed diplomacy and has said it is buying Israel more time to kill. Israel is, quote-unquote, welcoming Blinken, to Israel by plundering more Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, the PA has said. This is while Israeli strikes on Gaza have not slowed down a bit. One recent strike killed 7 staff members of the charity group World Central Kitchen. The group said it was a targeted attack. A brutal raid on Al-Shifa Hospital, which is Gaza's largest medical facility, has left it in ruins. The Israeli military has ordered hundreds of patients, medical staff, and people sheltering at the hospital because their homes have been bombed to ruins to evacuate.
Days ago, the United States approved the transfer of a new massive package of weapons comprising of bombs and fighter jets to Israel that is worth $2.5 billion. With support from the U.S., the Israeli regime has been able to carry out what is essentially an American war, even as Israeli soldiers seem to be fighting on the ground. The U.S. military-industrial complex is expected to make infinite profits in that time span as an American ally purges occupied land of its original inhabitants.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A U.S. federal judge overseeing Donald Trump's prosecution on charges of retaining classified documents has denied his efforts to have the case dismissed on the contention that the Presidential Records Act allowed him to transform them as personal property and possess them at his Mar-a-Lago club. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump faced mounting trouble recently in his legal universe, with judges overseeing 2 of Trump's legal cases refusing to accept his attempts to delay and toss the prosecution, and the former president doubling down on efforts to discredit his opponents. The judge overseeing Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York expanded a gag order recently, which had originally banned Donald Trump from making public statements about court staff, trial witnesses, or the families of any counsel or staff member on the case. The narrower gag order did not prohibit Donald Trump from making statements about family members of the judge, and after Judge Juan Merchan issued it, the former president took to social media to attack the judge's daughter. Identifying her by name, Donald Trump, on the social media platform Truth Social, wrote, "His daughter is a rabid Trump hater." The new gag order would now prevent him from making statements like that, but Trump's abusive commentary about her and others involved with this trial has probably already prompted threats and harassment. In a court filing revealed recently, Donald Trump also motioned for Judge Juan Merchan to recuse himself from the case, alleging his daughter's consulting work for Democratic clients was a conflict of interest. Donald Trump's lawyers in the court filing wrote, "It can no longer be ignored that Authentic's commercial interests are benefiting by developments in this case. This is the second time that Donald Trump has attempted to oust the judge over his daughter's work. Last year, an ethics panel reviewed a similar argument by Trump's legal team, but found Judge Juan Merchan's daughter and her firm did not pose a conflict of interest. Judge Juan Merchan denied on 3rd of April Trump's last-minute attempt